Morning, ladies and gentlemen. I understand we're having a little change in the schedule this morning. We'll proceed initially with the United States versus Coleman. Mr. Rocker,
you have
a little child, I gather?
Yes, and I have children. My wife is out of the country, and my flight doesn't appear that I'll be able to make it back. I do very much appreciate, by the way, the court's courtesy in that regard, and I thank counsel as well for his courtesy. May it please the court, Michael Rocker from the Department of Justice on behalf of the appellant, the United States of America. The district court in this case had granted Mr. Coleman's Section 2255 motion to remedy a misapplication of the advisory career offender guideline. But following the district court's decision, this court squarely held in Hawkins versus the United States.
Not so squarely. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Well, in our view, the court in Hawkins embraced the principle that the same exact error was not a cognizable claim for collateral relief. And in our view, we think Hawkins is controlling of the present case before. I understand Your Honor may have some questions for me about that. And I do appreciate and I understand Your Honor's position on that matter. But, you know, the majority didn't accept that. And until the en banc court chooses to revisit it, it, of course, remains binding. The two principal arguments that I understand have been advanced by my opponent, let me just briefly address. The first point, I think, as I read the supplemental filings, was that even though this was an advisory guideline sentencing, the district court somehow treated the guidelines as mandatory, and therefore this case is really governed by the Narvaez decision. But with all due respect, there's simply no factual support. The sentencing in this case occurred in November of 2007, almost 3 years after Booker, and the district judge was quite familiar and I think can be reasonably presumed to have known that the guidelines were in fact advisory. If you look at the transcript of sentencing, the court specifically referred on two or three different occasions to the advisory nature of the guidelines. It spoke of the Section 3553A factors and the need to tailor an appropriate sentence. So as a factual matter, I just don't see any basis for concluding that the court, some 3 years after Booker, thought the guidelines were really mandatory. And the second argument, of course, is the more sweeping one, which is, as I understand it, effectively that Judge Roedner was correct and that the court should simply follow the lead of other circuits that have disagreed with the majority in Hawkins.
How do you respond to the reasoning of the Fourth Circuit in Whiteside?
Your Honor, I think largely those issues were covered by the majority in Hawkins, and I know Your Honor is quite familiar with that. I think it's reasonable minds perhaps can differ about the outcome. The government's position has been all along that no guidelines errors are cognizable. Now, the court disagreed with us in Narvaez as far as mandatory errors, and Hawkins produced a spirited discussion among the members of this court. But I think that, with all due respect, the panel decision in Spencer, the 11th Circuit case, even though it's been vacated, I guess you could still look at it as persuasive. And Whiteside, the government, of course, is still considering whether to pursue further review. But unless and until Hawkins is set aside, it's, as far as this court is concerned, I think it's just a simple task of following the precedent in Hawkins. We disagree with Whiteside, and I think Hawkins bolsters that conclusion.
You know, in this case, the actual impact of the error is really apparent in that, you know, the sentence without consideration of the career offender designation was 100 months less. 100
right.
months less. I mean, shouldn't we reconsider the application of Hawkins in light of real-world evidence that the career offender designation, in fact, has a demonstrable impact on the length of sentence that is imposed?
Well, I appreciate the court's question. I think, with all due respect, that Hawkins addressed those issues. And I think the point was it's not so – I mean, look, in Hawkins, I believe the advisory guidelines range was 24 to 30 months, and the resulting sentence wound up being in the low 100s. I don't remember the exact figure. So, yes, there's no – I mean, no one's denying that even at an advisory level, the career offender guideline has a pronounced effect. But remember – And if this were a case on direct review, it may well be that there would be a reversal, you know, for procedural error for miscalculating the guidelines range. But as the Supreme Court told us in United States versus Adonisio, which was not a guidelines case, but it's still precedent, an error that might support relief on direct review won't necessarily sustain a collateral attack. And something more has to be shown. And what Adonisio said is we have to focus not subjectively on the particular impact of the error, but we look objectively to determine whether or not a miscarriage of justice occurred. And I think if you look at the objective indicators here, The sentence, by all accounts and by everyone's admission, is within the statutory limits. This is not an ACCA case where the sentence goes above, and it's not illegal. It's an error. But a miscarriage of justice is something more than an error. And in light of the ruling in Hawkins, you know, we don't think that there can be any basis for finding that this is a miscarriage of justice. Now, Your Honor's question also asked whether the Hawkins should be reconsidered. That's certainly the en banc court's prerogative. But again, for purposes of the three-judge panel in front of which I now stand, I don't think there's really much wiggle room. We think that Hawkins is controlling. There's no factual basis for distinguishing it. It adopted a rule of law, and that rule of law applies here.
Have you any idea of whether the 11th Circuit has said it's en banc hearing?
Yes, they have, Your Honor. For the record, I'm counsel for the United States in that matter, and it is my brief, the government's brief is due at the end of the
day. Oh, I wish you weren't so good.
Well, I'm flattered, Your Honor, the government's brief is due at the end of May, and the case will be argued June 24th in Atlanta. And I will certainly keep the court apprised of any further developments in that case, and also to the extent the government seeks further review or does not seek further review in the Whiteside case, although, again, at the risk of sounding like a broken record.
How far along are you in that case?
I'm sorry?
How far along are you in that case?
In Whiteside? Mm-hmm. The decision is only a few weeks old, and I believe under the Fourth Circuit rules it's a 45-day window because it's considered civil, so the petition for rehearing en banc wouldn't be due until maybe early June.
But not a great
No, it's a relatively, I think it was April 8th, my anniversary was the date of the decision. I remember it well.
Mr. Rocker, I'm newer to this than my colleagues here. I know they were on opposite sides of some of these cases.
Sure.
But here's my question for you is, in my summary of Hawkins would be that there was a finality on the one hand and then some concept of fundamental fairness or whatever the right adjective would be on
sure.
the other end. Why isn't this case the finality actually push in favor of the resentencing? I mean, the fact is one of the concerns the majority had in Hawkins was the idea that we would have a whole bunch of more work for district judges to do to have to go back and resentence all these folks. Well, here, he's already been resentenced. And as Judge Rovner says, we know that the very same judge felt that 100 months difference in sentence was justified based on the change in the law. Why doesn't the finality principle in this case cut in favor of letting things stand as they are? And so you've got both the fundamental fairness of Narvaez and the finality concern of Hawkins pointing both the arrows in the same direction in this case.
Right. It's a fair question, Your Honor. I would say that I think that the finality versus fairness is a useful metaphor, I think, for how to describe the competing considerations in any collateral attack. But I think that the analysis in Hawkins is that the policy concerns didn't drive the ruling. I mean, the policy concerns are what they are, which is policy concerns. It's the threshold legal point. And no one disputed in Hawkins, and I don't think there's any dispute here, that the Supreme Court has said when we're dealing with a non-constitutional, non-jurisdictional error, it's not cognizable unless it amounts to a miscarriage of justice. And that may sort of tilt into the fundamental fairness side of things. But the way Hawkins, I think, looked at it and the way we would look at it is what I was saying in response to Judge Rovner, that we have to have something more than just a subjective feel for what's fundamentally fair. There's no dispute, again. I mean, we conceded below and we're not disputing here that there was an error, but something more. There's, I think Judge Easterbrook had an old case called Springs, which is cited in our brief, where he said there's a big gulf between an error and a miscarriage of justice. And, you know, it may be that on the particular facts here, there are, you know, less of the finality concerns. It doesn't change the fact, though, that sort of you don't get to that. In our view, in other words, there never should have been the resentencing. Now, we couldn't appeal as a matter of law until the resentencing occurred. So I think, you know, to use that against us, I think in somehow we're just bound by the law, and the law said it's not final until the resentencing occurred. But I think ultimately the question is, how do we measure whether something's a miscarriage? And under Adonisio, it's an objective test. It's not subjectively. We don't sort of look, as we would on direct review, for example, in deciding whether an error is harmless or prejudicial. It's fair and I think appropriate to say, well, the district judge said that even if the enhancement didn't apply, he would have given the same sentence. That kind of subjective view is perfectly appropriate for direct appeal. Mm-hmm. But in a collateral attack, it's an objective indicator.
But even if it's objective, then there'd be some continuum, and I suppose the government would probably acknowledge that somewhere in that continuum you get into fundamental unfairness. And I suppose you could say that you know, another appeal would be the judge miscalculated the guideline range, and the guideline range was 36 to 47,
right.
and he used 46 to 57.
Right.
We'd all say, well, that's trivial enough, and certainly in an advisory guideline range,
right.
in most cases it won't make a difference.
Right.
Then you could have the person who was sentenced to death wrongfully, and we could all agree that that's on the other end
right.
of the continuum. But at what point does 100 months start to sound like objectively fundamentally unfair?
Well, in our view,
is it 200 months?
I mean,
what
I,
is it?
I mean, I think that's kind of the slippery slope point. I think the 11th Circuit's decision in a case called Gilbert, which was a mandatory guidelines error, but I think it's still analogous, where the court was concerned with the idea that there really is, at least in our view, no principled way to draw that line that Your Honor is suggesting. I mean, where is the line that says, trivial versus significant versus death? I mean, yes, we can all agree that an illegal death sentence shouldn't stand.
Isn't every three-part test that comes out of the court
right.
sound a lot like that, though?
In some ways, yes, but I think here there's no way for cabining that. There's no way, and that's why I think the objective standard, which focuses on a couple of criteria, the most important of which is, was the sentence within statutory limits? I mean, take the facts of Adonisio, which I think it's a parole guidelines case, but I still think it's a very useful analogy. The judge in that case imposed a 10-year sentence, and that was the statutory maximum. But he did so because he believed that the defendant would be paroled after a third of that term. Now, the parole guidelines came out later and proved that assumption was wrong, and the effect was the defendant had to serve the full 10 years. That's 6 2/3 extra years. The Supreme Court said that's not the kind of error that could be the basis for opening the doors for Section 2255. And what the court did, is, as I've said, is they focused on the objective criteria, which are that the sentence was within statutory limits, and that it's just not the kind of error historically that's been deemed sufficient enough to outweigh the finality concerns. And what I would say, just the last point, in our view, there are some sentences that are fundamentally unfair and merit this kind of relief in the ACCA context. Because there you're talking about a sentence that is illegal by any yardstick. It is above the statutory maximum. And as I know the court well knows, it's one thing to say judges have broad latitude to sentence within statutory limits, but we don't have common law punishments. We don't have judges that can simply impose a sentence without regard for the limits set by the legislature. The ACCA context is a perfect example of where the fundamental fairness balance tilts against finality. And we've acknowledged as much. I believe the court in Welch has said as much. But guidelines cases are fundamentally different. And in light of Hawkins, we simply think that the proper disposition here is to reverse the district court.
I have one more question
yes,
for you, and
please.
I think you're obviously the right man for this question because you're arguing all these cases. But here's my question. So
yes.
In order to get into Mr. Coleman's shoes, you got to have there's a lot of filters you got to go through.
Yes.
You have to be sentenced post-Booker
right.
as a career offender. Then you have to have the good fortune of having the law of career offender change in your favor, which happens once in a while.
Right.
Then you have to have been bring your 2255 motion. Mm-hmm. You have to have been resentenced after Narvaez but before Hawkins.
Right.
How many people could this possibly apply to, even across the country, if you have to run all those filters? And now, at least in our circuit, it can't happen again because of Hawkins.
Right.
So it's only people who had the good fortune of running that entire gauntlet
right.
and then getting their sentence cut in half who are in Mr. Hawkins' position. Coleman's position.
Right. There certainly are a number of limits, and the Supreme Court has adopted those various doctrines, and then they're supplanted and supplemented by AEDPA. So there's timeliness limitations, there's procedural bar, there's Teague issues. Some of them don't come into play here. I mean, we've conceded that Begay and the cases like that apply, such as McDonald, which is at issue here, are retroactive. So we're not, we haven't interposed that. But those doctrines all serve distinct and complementary purposes. The fact that there may not be many cases that involve the McDonald decision doesn't take away, there are lots of decisions around the country. I mean, the 11th Circuit has had extensive litigation about various predicate offenses that were significant in the state of Florida. Carrying concealed firearm. Mm-hmm. It was thought to be a violent crime, and then it was reversed after Begay. Other circuits have taken similar approaches on recklessness. Reckless assault has been a big issue that the department has been litigating throughout the country. So, it may not be that there's going to be a lot of people involving the McDonald case, but there are always going to be new cases coming down after Begay.
But there won't be any new cases in our circuit after Hawkins, right?
I mean, not on the advisory front. That's right.
Right,
but
no one's getting sentenced these days under any other regime.
I hope not. No, I hope not. That's right. That's right. It may be a transitional issue. Mm-hmm. I guess the final point, though, is that as Your Honor may know, and I think the court is well aware, there is the escape hatch under the Savings Clause under Section 2241 that may allow recourse, certainly under this circuit's decision in Brown versus Carraway. which was a mandatory guidelines error. So you may have mandatory guidelines defendants that are still going to be litigating these cases regardless of what Hawkins did on the advisory front, if that made sense.
Okay.
So it's not, you know, the issue may be diminishing, but it's not going away altogether. And I think I'm a testament to the fact that these issues are popping up everywhere. We're dealing with all the permutations, advisory guidelines, mandatory guidelines, first 2255 savings clause cases. So the issues are, you know, unfortunately, alive and well. But again, just at the risk of repeating myself, the basic issue here we think is governed by Hawkins, and certainly if the court wants to revisit it en banc, that would be the court's prerogative. We think the court got it right, and on the basis of Hawkins, the court should reverse.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors.
Mr. Stevenson?
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, and may it please the court. 120 to 150 months, that is the range that the government and the defense agree that should have faced Mr. Coleman at sentencing. Yet if we leave him without a remedy here, his sentence will increase to nearly 20 years, 240 months, and it will rest based solely on an incorrect career offender label that both the government and defense agree should not and does not apply to him. This is the situation that defendants face across the country, as government has alluded to, and both following Hawkins and the Supreme Court's case in Pew, both circuits that have addressed the issue in that situation, the 4th and the 11th, have balanced the very finality and fairness that this court has identified to remedy these very significant errors that result in additional years, if not decades, of prison time. Mr. Coleman's case and others also demonstrate there are certain procedural mechanisms that can limit the finality and judicial efficiency concerns that this court and others have had. The Supreme Court's case law and this court's also has opened the door to these very types of claims, not foreclosing it, as the government suggests in the briefs. For these reasons, we ask that you affirm Mr. Coleman's sentence as well as the order of the district court. As an initial matter, the government claims that there is no factual support for the fact that Mr. Coleman's faced a presumptively reasonable guideline range. That's simply not the case. On the sentencing transcript on page 11, the court indicates its overarching desire to issue a sentence as near as long as the law will allow. It then cites the top of the guideline range. This court has faced situations where courts have acknowledged the advisory nature of the guidelines, in Panis, for instance, where this court held that that was not dispositive as to the fact that the court, in fact, treated the guidelines as advisory. Here, there is at least strong indication that there's a presumption of reasonableness here, which this court discussed in its Hawkins opinions, essentially setting up a spectrum between Narvaez and Hawkins, Hawkins being under the advisory context, Narvaez being under the strictly mandatory context. Mr. Coleman's case facing that presumption or possible that treatment of mandatory nature of the guidelines is closer to that of Narvaez, and therefore it suffers from the same fundamental defect that this court allowed to be remedied in Narvaez. Furthermore, just a matter of clarification, Mr. Coleman does still have remaining claims in the district court, even if this court were to reverse the district court's decision. Mr. Coleman continues to assert that he received both ineffective assistance of trial counsel and appellate counsel for decisions related to United States versus Shannon, as well as Begay at the trial court and appellate court, respectively. However, again, this is the most judicially efficient mechanism in which to remedy this claim. Because if this claim goes back, it goes back to ineffective assistance of counsel, and it requires the same marshalling of resources that this court addressed in Hawkins, again, getting to the point of judicial efficiency, and this being the most expeditious, clearest way in order to remedy this significant error. Speaking of Hawkins, Mr. Coleman again does feel that this court should readdress its decision on Hawkins, whether it be this panel majority or while sitting en banc. And that's following the cases of Spencer and Whiteside that this court and the government did discuss at some length. Spencer has been vacated for a hearing en banc, but Whiteside, which came out after being vacated for a hearing en banc, acknowledged that fact and yet still adopted the reasoning of Spencer as the basis for its decision. And in both situations, the courts noted that there is a significant impact of these career offender designations, getting to Your Honor's point with regard to the range of fairness here. Individuals faced with a criminal history category of 6, but not being a career offender, had a mean sentence of 84 months. Those same individuals, category 6 again, but career offenders this time over, faced a mean sentence of 163 months. This is actual sentence received. This mirrors, Mr. Coleman is the actual case that proves this rule. It's a near doubling of sentence. Mr. Coleman received 120 months on resentencing, while in the initial sentencing under the incorrect career offender label, he received a sentence of 225 months. Again, nearly double what he received on resentencing. Without an error, that sentence puts back into place because of an error that everyone acknowledges exists. In addition, in Hawkins, the court noted that 53.1%, I believe was the statistic, of sentences were within the guidelines, indicating that the guidelines don't have the gravitational pull, as Judge Rovner indicated in her dissent. However, when you control for the government-sponsored departures, whether it be for cooperation or otherwise, that number actually jumps significantly. In 2007, when Mr. Coleman was sentenced, that number was actually 82%. So 82% of sentences were within the guidelines, controlling for government-sponsored departures, allowing for a court to go below the guidelines. Even in 2012, so well into the advisory context that the government alludes to, that number is still close to 75%. Again, controlling for government-sponsored departures. These are significant errors. And Spencer and Whiteside also discussed at length the foundational principle of Pew that the guidelines are the lodestone of sentencing. And that's borne out by the statistics that I cited earlier about the 163-month mean sentence for career offenders versus the 84-month sentence for non-career offenders, but yet still with that criminal history score of 6. Guidelines do have a major impact, and again, Mr. Coleman felt that impact incorrectly at sentencing and is now under that correct sentence and under that correct guideline. The government alluded to the fact that reasonable minds can differ on this point. The most recent minds on this point, Spencer and Whiteside, have ruled in the exact opposite fashion. Based upon the Supreme Court's decision in Pew, based upon prior Supreme Court precedent, its own circuit's precedent, and an analysis of Sunbear in the Eighth Circuit, Hawkins here, and the other cases that have addressed this issue. Mr. Coleman suffered a significant impact because of his incorrect label. Everyone agrees with that, and everyone acknowledges his guideline range should have been different. The starting point for his sentencing journey should have been different. And he received a significantly lower sentence. And he should not have to have his sentence go up, and again, supported solely by an incorrect career offender label. We ask that the court uphold the district court's decision granting his post-conviction motion as well as his new correct sentence, because at the very least, the district court presumed it was reasonable, if not mandatory. And we ask this court to readdress Hawkins, given the announcements in Spencer and Whiteside. And if there are no further questions, I will forego the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
How much time?
1 minute. I won't even use half of that. Just very briefly, Your Honors, on the question of whether the guidelines were treated as mandatory, just a couple of snippets from the sentencing transcript, which again was almost 3 years after Booker. The court will impose a sentence consistent with the provisions of 18 U.S.C. 3553A. The court will use the 2007 guidelines manual, which is advisory, in determining an appropriate sentence within the statutory limits. That's page 4. The court also asked counsel if they wanted to make any arguments in support of a variance and declined to go below the guidelines range, and I think that's the telltale sign that there's really, they're focusing on one statement to the exclusion of the rest of the transcript. I know the court will read the transcript, and you'll see that this was an advisory sentence. There's no reason to believe the district court somehow thought they were mandatory. Thank you very much for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you. Have a good trip back.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.